Hey, you guys, it's Monday.
Yeah.
We're back once again with another haunting show.
Yeah, this one you can see on YouTube, but you have a hard time finding it because they have it labeled strangely. And it does, remember, they have it set up as like a documentary, not an episode of the haunting.
Well, it's because, it's because this one was their first special.
Right.
Like, before this went to series. They did two pilot episodes, and this was the first one of those. The other one was a haunting in Georgia about Mr. Gordy.
Yeah.
Like, we did a show about that case a long time ago. And I feel like we've talked about this case, too, but it's weird because, man, this episode, I don't even want to call it an episode because it's, like, it's longer than a regular episode. It's, like, an hour and a half, so it's, like, movie length.
Yeah.
And it was, like, a pilot, so I don't know. I'm just assuming that they made these two seeing if there was enough interest, like, to do a series, and then there was, so they went ahead and did it. So they made this, and you have to buy them separately. Like, from, they don't come with in the box sets with the series. And this, I had a bitch of a time finding this shit because you can't stream it legally anywhere. I couldn't find it any place, at least in the United States. Nobody had it. So somebody uploaded it to YouTube, and it's really shitty. Like, the, it looks shitty. It sounds shitty.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it looks terrible. But that was like the only place, and it took me like forever to find it because.
You remember the title?
I had to put in. Well, see, the weird thing is that the title of it is just like A Haunting in Connecticut, yada yada. But I had to put in, because I put in A Haunting in Connecticut 2002, because if you put in A Haunting in Connecticut, it'll be all the stuff about the 2009 movie, which was made like the fictional movie. So I put in 2002, and then I got it to come up on my computer, but I couldn't get it to come up on the Xbox when I did the search in there. And so then I finally, like, put in A Haunting in Connecticut TV movie, and then it came up. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it had, like, a white icon, I think, wasn't it? With some script, something written on it.
Yeah, I think it was like, it was a shot from the show, which was like almost like a drone shot of like snowy, like a snowy, like a cemetery or something. Like, I couldn't really tell what it is because, like I said, it looked like super, super shitty.
So you can order this on DVD?
Yeah, I think you can get it on, I think you can get it on DVD, but it's not streaming anywhere though.
Does it come with the Mr. Gordy episode, or are they sold separately?
I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I thought when I looked on Amazon earlier, I thought they sold a DVD or a Blu-ray that had both of them on one
both
disc.
Both pilots, okay.
But
it might be worth buying.
Maybe not. I don't remember how much it was or anything like that.
Probably get to use them for a couple bucks.
I would imagine you can. I mean, this is like I said, this is really old. This is like 2002. So this is like 20 years old at this point. Here's the weird thing. I remembered like so much about this story. But when we started watching this episode, it occurred to me that what I was remembering mostly was from the Paranormal Witness episode.
Yeah.
Because on this episode, this is really weird. I mean, I guess I can see it. Because like I said, this is 2002. On this episode, they did not use any of their real names, and they all, like, everybody, all the real people that are on the show, they all appeared in shadow. But then, like, several years later, when they did a Paranormal Witness episode, they absolutely used their own names and let their faces be shown and stuff. I kind of feel like, I don't know, I think they didn't really know this early on, like, what the reaction would be, and then after it was, like, really positive, like, and successful, and then there's a book about it, which I'll get into in a little bit, but then they were like, well, hell, we're going to use our real names and maybe we can cash in on this shit.
Well, in 2002, the Snedeker case would have been long forgotten. That was something you saw on Geraldo when you were a kid in fucking 86, 85, you know, around that time.
Well, it happened, like, the stuff that happened to them was 86. And I think the book that came out, I think, was 92.
Okay. Because I remember seeing that shit on Geraldo when it was relatively new.
Yeah.
The Snedeker case. And a lot of the audience was mocking them. But on some shows, like, they would go on, Donahue, I think? Sometimes they'd take that fucking seriously. I don't even think Ricky Lake was out yet. I think that was late. No, she was around. But the Snedekers were hitting all the talk shows.
Well, yeah.
And each one was, like, a little bit of a different reaction. And I guess that was, I was out of high school, so I guess it was 87 when I saw it. On daytime television talk show. And I was kind of spooked. I was buying it for the most part after, you know, Math Mountain. What happened there? I thought that maybe like this was plausible. And seeing the original Paranormal Witness and seeing this episode, I thought there might have been something to it. I'm not so sure now, but
yeah, I actually wrote about this case in my book, The Unseen Hand, and I don't really want to, you know, spoil stuff right out of the gate, because this is a good story. Yeah. I mean, this is one of the creepiest episodes.
Yeah.
But I will say that there has been a lot of speculation that this is kind of like an Amityville kind of situation.
That it might have been
where they were just
fabricated,
like,
from the very beginning. Maybe.
Yeah.
I remember there was like a lot of inconsistencies in the stories and inconsistency between the story that's told to the public and then what the original witness testimony was. I remember that there was a lot of that kind of stuff. Like, well, wait a minute, hold on. That's not exactly what that witness said. You know, just like that the early accounts differ from later accounts. That kind of stuff. The story gets bigger as it goes. There's a lot of... I don't remember all the details because, you know, like I said, I hadn't really researched it recently. But I remembered that the story kind of gets bigger the older it gets. Like Roswell. Story got bigger as it went, you know, which that's a sign of something becoming a legend.
Yeah, I definitely do want to kind of get into that toward the end, because like I said, we'll talk about the show and like what the stuff, but I do want to kind of get into it toward the, because Carmen Snedeker, her stories have kind of like, her, the details are inconsistent, like over the years, like because she's given a fuck ton of like interviews.
Some of the shit's wild too, like getting butt horked running down the street in public, all by demons.
Although they
and shit.
Left that out the show.
Yeah, they left that out
they
the show.
They didn't even mention that in the episode.
She said that shit on fucking on a daytime talk show. Back in the 80s, I was like, what? Well,
you got to up your game if you're on a daytime talk show. If you
when she
like
said that on daytime talk show, it had to be true.
How funny would it be if she actually used the term butt horked?
That's what I imagine. Fucking right out of out of the Rastan video
that
game.
So awesome.
Fucking spiky.
Butt horked by a demon. The Carmen Snedeker story.
Yeah. So, and my thinking of the time as you know, late teenager, was that if the claim was wild fucking like that, then it had to have been true. How could anybody make that up?
What are you talking about? I'm a horror writer. I make up crazy shit all day long.
How could somebody make... That was my thinking at the time. She said she was running down the street getting raped by the ghosts up in her ass. In public.
I'm not suggesting that rape is funny, but that whole entire...
And I was like, how could somebody make that up?
That mental image is very, very funny.
Invisible ghosts. Invisible demons butt-horking you while you're running. Running away. And I was like, yeah, that shit had to happen, man. No woman would make that up, you know?
That and sounds then, like some shit I would make up.
Yeah.
Like for a story or something.
They were holding one girl down while it was ghosts were molesting her. And she said she could see the hand, and then the hand underneath her clothes of her nightie fucking going up. She could see the knuckles on that hand as it was grabbing her titty, basically. That's what she said.
Yeah, and
that fucking spooked me. Because I had seen some shit at Mammoth Mountain, some poltergeist activity. I'd never seen anything that looked like a hand, but, you know, moving objects and things appearing and disappearing and kind of ghostly fucking force kind of touch you. You know, well, that was with Lois. And so I thought maybe it was like, damn, you know, that whatever they saw, that was a strong one. And I could see that, I could imagine that something like that would be plausible, that it was so strong that the apparition of the hand underneath the clothing that you could see the knuckles and the fingers on it. I could imagine it. I don't think it happened, but I could imagine it. I saw something kind of like that. It just looked like a damn white blur of, I guess, I don't know, like a hand-like object jump off the back of a damn rocking chair and then just vanish. And I don't know if it was a hand, but just think of some kind of force. It was weird. It was so fast, I couldn't make an image out of it. It was weird, though. It kind of made it a connection with that and her account of the hand underneath her nightie fucking going up. It just creeped me out.
Danny Rowling said, didn't the niece get groped and molested by the entity in the house? Yeah, that's what we were just, talking,
what we're
about.
Just talking about.
But the thing about it is that they didn't put that into the haunting episode.
No.
I remembered that, but I remembered it because, one, I wrote about this case, and two, they did mention it on Paranormal Witness.
Yeah.
Because many years later, I can't remember what year it was, but Paranormal Witness did this case too. It was season 2, episode 7. And I think it was called The Real Haunting in Connecticut. So I'm assuming they put it out sometime around 2009, like in conjunction with the big Hollywood movie that they made that was based on this case. So I remember that episode like a lot more than this one. This one was a lot more restrained, like in the stuff they showed. They didn't mention the butt horking. They didn't mention, you know, the molestation, really. They just kind of, they kind of danced around it a little bit, but I mean, I think the Paranormal Witness episode was a lot more overt, although I think they also left out the butt horking.
What I was remember thinking at the time is I thought it was the son who was dying of cancer. They moved him into this mortuary, and it caused a lot of damn internal conflicts, and I thought it had released his RSPK, or in other words, it caused him to create a poltergeist. And his cousin was in there with him, and she was the one that was getting molested, and I thought maybe it might have been some kind of subconscious incestual desire for his cousin. They were about the same age.
Well, he did jump on her and try to rape her.
Right.
I think there was a 3-year difference. I think he was 3 years younger.
He was younger? Okay. And that the poltergeist was doing it too to her, but it was emanating from him. You know, poltergeist is not really a ghost for you new listeners. It's an artificial ghost. It's just psychic abilities, telekinesis, under the direction of the subconscious mind. And you think it's an outside force. It's actually a part of you doing it. And it was trying to rape his cousin, you know. Fucking. And so it seemed very plausible to me with having seen this phenomenon before. But there's a lot of inconsistencies in the story. In the end, I remembered thinking that it was artificial, that they had based it on stuff, but it was...
I mean, I hate to...
I think it was.
I hate to, like, just call out anybody for just, like, making stuff up out of whole cloth, but you have to think, too, like, the Warrens were involved in this, and you know how that kind of shit goes.
Right.
And, like I said, I kind of want to talk about the guy that wrote the book about it and what he said. So I kind of want to get to you toward the end.
I think my final—I haven't looked at this case in a long time. I kind of remember feeling or believing that my final thoughts on it were that something may have happened, but it got really exaggerated, possibly. You know?
Yeah, Well, that's what usually happens. Yeah. I kind of feel like. I mean, if you have, I think this is very similar to Amityville because Amityville was a house where demonstrably something horrible happened. I mean, DeFeo like killed his whole family. You know what I mean? So it's kind of the same thing here. I mean, the house demonstrably did used to be a funeral home.
Yeah.
So maybe when they moved in, they were like, you know, hey, medical bills aren't cheap. Maybe we should play this up and like do kind of like, you know, I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm just saying that the pump is already primed because it's like, you know, obviously, like I said, just like the Amityville house, obviously a horrible multiple murder occurred there. So people are going to be more primed to believe that maybe there's like some supernatural activity going on because something horrible happened. So same thing here because the place used to be a funeral home, which everybody kind of knew.
Well, I remember thinking that maybe some kind of poltergeist phenomenon had happened because of the stress, but that then that phenomenon wasn't good enough for the mass media, so they kept exaggerating it.
Yeah,
and making it stronger, you know what I mean? More impressive. Some of that stuff I think she just made up out of whole cloth during those live television shows that they were doing on daytime television. You know, I think they're live before the audience, but I think they're recorded.
Yeah, they are.
So some of that shit she'd run off at the mouth, Miss Snedeker, and probably because she was trying to fight the audience, convince them that it had really happened. And some of that stuff probably didn't happen. But I think some things maybe happened, but they got buried underneath a lot of exaggeration.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be willing to admit, like, maybe they moved in and there was, like, some creepy shit, like doors opening by themselves or some shit like that. But
visions,
it's like
apparitions and stuff, and maybe objects.
But maybe it was, like, really, really minor.
Yeah, and maybe things that kind of seemed like possession because he was losing his fucking mind because he thought he was dying, and then maybe some ghostly poltergeist type phenomenon with like sexual intent, fucking going after his cousin. Because he went after her, if I remember correctly, he walked into her bedroom, jumped on top of her, and tried to have sex with her.
Yeah.
In the middle of the night.
Yeah, I'll get into it.
He was under the influence of a bunch of drugs, though, too. So who knows?
Sarah said, in love with that shirt, Jenny. Thank you very much. I've worn this before, I think. We made this one. I designed it and we printed it. Zach said, my thought is, how would you be able to fuck anyone while running in general? And that just gives images of a couple having a fuck jog.
Yes. You're running from this invisible force that is repeatedly butt-horking you without any kind of lubricant or anything, and you're flying up into the air with each thrust, and you can't see it, and fucking everybody's looking at you like you're a fucking
cause
moron.
Because you're just going, woo,
because you're just woo. Jumping and running. and they're trying to take fucking pictures of you and shit as this is happening, and nobody sees anything. Imagine that.
Yeah, that would be, yeah. That's hilarious.
And they couldn't take pictures of you because there weren't any cell phones back then.
October 8th said, I'm going to buy Jen's books. I didn't realize that Jen was an author. Yeah, I've written lots of
stuff. Oh, yeah, she wrote a lot of books. See, if you want to read about this kind of stuff, get Unseen Hand. It's real good.
Yeah, it's kind of a compilation of poltergeist cases.
Yeah.
I also wrote 3 true crime compilation books and a bunch of fiction.
We never plug books. We never plug shirts. We don't even fucking make any money. We just let the shit run.
Well, I just like forget about it.
We forget all about it.
And it's like, and I'm one of those kind of people that is just like, I write books, I do stuff like that, and then I just kind of put them out there, and I'm just kind of like, hey, if somebody wants to read them, that's cool. I don't really like.
And she's got audiobook too.
I'm not a natural salesperson.
we forget all about audiobooks. If you guys like the show, some of those audiobooks are fucking 4 hours long, huh? Maybe even more. Some of them. I think Unseen Hand is available on audiobook, isn't it?
Yeah, I did.
Jenny reads it.
Yeah, I did an audiobook version of it.
Yeah, and the recordings are pretty good.
Yeah.
The first few books, we had re-recorded it a couple times, I think, to try to get the audio right. So sometimes on her early books, you'll see some negative dings on the audio quality. That got corrected.
Yeah.
Everything's updated.
I re-recorded, I think, everything.
Yeah.
Like, you know. Fairly recently, or just like a couple of years ago.
Yeah, good microphone. We got EQ and fucking sound booth. Had all that shit set up.
Yep, that's right. All right, so Danny Rowling also said this episode was far superior to the Hollywood BS film. Yeah, I remember I saw the movie, but I don't. It was a lot different. I remember it being okay, but I don't know. I don't really remember that much about it, so it didn't really make an impression. Danny Rowling said, did you guys like this episode? Yeah, I actually do really like this episode. It's just weird because, like I said, I had forgotten. I was thinking, I remembered a lot about this case, but I was thinking of the Paranormal Witness episode. We'd seen this before, but we must have only seen it once. Because when we were watching it again, I'm like, I barely remember this. I said, when I'm thinking about it, I'm remembering the Paranormal Witness episode.
Did you hear what's this at Galcom? He said he misses the commercials.
Yeah.
Did we have the commercials recorded still? We had a fucking play commercial.
Yeah, I got all kind of. I know. Well,
I never do it.
I know. I just forget.
Forget.
I got lots of commercials. I got.
Yeah, we've been off of our game, really, when it comes to selling shit.
Well, it's a lot of stuff to keep track of.
Yeah.
And, you know.
We need to start running our commercials and plugging a little bit more, because I bet you sales would go up, because they're just kind of running on autopilot, aren't they?
Yeah, essentially. Now I
essentially do make a couple hundred bucks off of my
room. Now on my my crime and memorial videos, I put I put a commercial in that, and I put on my scare salon videos, I put commercials for some of my horror novels and my games and stuff. I made commercials for that stuff, so I do put them in there. But I forget, because to do them on the live stream. you know, I have to, like, put them over here on this computer, and I have to, like, load them into the scenes. And then, like, sometimes we're just, like, having fun on the show, and we're drinking, and I just, like, forget.
We need to get that shit loaded up so we can just, at the drop of a hat, you need to go use the restroom, we'll just start playing commercials.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we used to do.
Yeah, we need to get back on the game. We've been lazy.
Cheng said the Warrens were involved. Yeah, that's all I need to know.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Although, look, man, the Warrens were involved in, obliquely... in the fucking Enfield case, and that's one of the best poltergeist cases. I got the fucking book on it in here called This House is Haunted, and that is really close to what we saw at Math Mountain. And now there is some witness accounts in the Enfield case that I don't think happened, because there's just so many damn witnesses, chances are some people are going to make some shit up. But what newspaper reporters and cops saw, and the main witnesses, like Guy Lyon Playfair and what was his name? Morris Gross. Even the girls themselves, what they reported, I believe, did happen. All right. But what the crossing guard across the street said she saw, that girl floating up through the... I don't know if she saw that for real. You know, no one reported that except that crossing guard. Although a weird thing did happen in that case. Janet said that she fell through the wall and left her book on the other side. And in the other... She was asleep and fell through the wall, I think is what she said. And then came back. And she left her book over there. And her book was evidently in the apartment next door. That had come from her room. But I don't know if that actually happened. In a poltergeist case, objects can do that. They can kind of teleport. I don't know if she teleported over there with the book in her hand. Or if the book just teleported over there and she dreamt that. Because she said she was asleep when it happened. But that was a weird element of that case. She had no way of getting in that other apartment. You know? She didn't have a key. Yeah. But her book was over there.
I don't know. The Warrens weren't really... I wouldn't call them being involved in that case. They turned up on the doorstep one day.
They claimed to have been involved. And then they got kicked out off there. Like, who are you? And they kicked them out.
They didn't really know who they were.
Yeah, yeah.
So...
But then they'd walk around and go, oh, yeah, we were involved in that case. Even though originally... what was his name? Warren. What's the guy's name?
Ed.
Ed, yeah. Ed said, yeah, we saw that case. There was nothing to it. It was a hoax. That's what he said. But then later he says, oh, no, that was a fantastic case. He made a whole fucking movie. They tried to fucking weasel his ass into it.
Yeah, I mean, we've done two whole shows on the Warrens. Yeah. They just, like I said, Lorraine always kind of seemed like a nice lady and a true believer, but Ed just seemed like a huckster. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And that actually comes into play in this case later on, which we'll get into.
No matter what you said you saw, Ed was going to say it was a demon, and he was going to fucking encourage you to fucking make the story more impressive. In other words, lie.
So they could write it up and go on a lecture tour with it.
Yeah.
And they could, like, make themselves seem more impressive.
Yeah, and it was just a definite pattern.
About fighting these demons and
fighting
shit.
Demons and fighting Medusa and fucking fighting anything, you know. But they were just fighting werewolves. He killed a werewolf or something.
I'm pretty sure. I'm kind of why I want to spend money on it, but they did write a book about a werewolf. I can't remember what the name of it is.
So
I kind of want to read it, though.
Yeah, and then to collect everything in a museum that you have to pay to see everything. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what happened to that. Did Zaphis take that over?
I think
after they died?
He's guarding all those relics,
like Annabelle the doll and all that kind of stuff. The thing about it, they're fucking. I don't know like how much money they get from like the Conjuring universe. Well, obviously they don't get any money now because they're both dead. But I'm just saying their estate. I'm saying because of the Conjuring universe movies, which are kind of like based all on their shit. Like it's a whole extended universe made out of all their cases. And so I'd be curious as to like how much they got paid for that shit. So I don't know. I'm sure somebody knows, but I don't. Let's see. October Reed said grift. Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Like I said.
So you want to get into this?
Yeah.
All right.
So as I mentioned, this was the pilot for A Haunting. So it was an hour and a half. It was like a movie. And interestingly, even though the Snedekers were very public later on about using their real names and their real faces, like I said, they did a Paranormal Witness episode right around 2009, 2010. They also were on Mysteries of the Museum talking about the case, but I don't remember. I like that show, and I saw a lot of episodes, but I don't remember if I saw that one or not. But on this one, they didn't show their faces, so they're all in shadow. It was Carmen, one of the sons... who I think real name is Bradley, although they call him Bobby on the show, and the niece, whose real name is Tammy, but I think they called her Teresa on the show. So I think it was just the three of them, right? I think they were the only ones that were the real people on there. But on the show, they called them, the main couple, Ed and Karen Parker, but that's not their names. Like I said, it was Alan and Carmen Snedeker. And so that's kind of like... I don't know. But like I said, they thought they could make more money later on. I'll also note that I didn't even realize until I was watching this for a second time today was that this one didn't have like the... It still has Anthony Call as the narrator, but it doesn't have that iconic theme music. You know what I mean? Because it
yeah,
was
all the music's everything's different.
Yeah, yeah, it's a lot different. Like, it's not that different. Like, it's kind of like similar to the later ones. Like I said, it still has the same narrator and stuff, but it's still like not the way the show would eventually go. So, all right. So here's the story. And at least this is what they showed on A Haunting. And as I said, I'll get into like some more shit later because different iterations of this have different details. This one's pretty restrained as far as like some of the crazier shit they said about later on. So they used fake names. So I guess I'm going to use those two because that's just what I used, even though I know what their real names are. So you got the mom, who they call Karen Parker on here. And her oldest son, Paul, who was 14. Now, this is in 1986 that this is happening. So he's been diagnosed with cancer. I think it's Hodgkin's lymphoma, although they didn't say that on the show. And the doctors have said that he probably only has 6 months to live unless he undergoes these super, like, radical experimental treatments. Now, at this point, the family were living in upstate New York, but the treatments were at this hospital in Connecticut, and it was 300 miles away. So basically, they had to do like an 8-hour drive. I think it was like 8 hours round trip. Was
Damn.
It? Yeah, like every day, you know, so he could do the thing. So Karen was like, well, you know, I couldn't like take care of the rest of my family because, you know, I had three other kids and blah, 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 or the house or anything. And also these long drives were really taking a toll on the son, too, because he was stuck in the car for like 8 hours a day. And then he had to go and do the treatment and all that other kind of crap. So eventually the family decides, well, it would probably be smarter to move closer to the hospital so we don't have to like fucking drive 8 hours every day. So Ed, the dad, whose real name is Al, like I said, got his company to transfer him to Connecticut, and Karen started looking for a place to live near the hospital. Now, she said that a lot of people initially wouldn't rent to her because she had four kids, and that was kind of a big thing in the 80s because, far as I know, like my parents had the same kind of problem because they also had four kids, and yeah, some apartment complexes or some houses were like, absolutely not. We don't want four children running around, even though we were angels. But yeah, so she was running into problems. But finally, she stumbles across a really big house for a really, really good price. I don't think she knew initially the way they show it on the show, like she just kind of, I think they imply that she saw like the for rent sign outside and she went in and asked about it. Like, I don't think she knew. Because she was kind of, like, desperate at this point because she was getting turned down everywhere. So she saw the for rent sign. She's like, well, fuck it. I'll just, like, walk in there, even though I'm sure this is out of my price range. Because I don't know if I'm necessarily... Because I know what the address of the house is. It's very, very easy to find if you want to. You know, on paranormal websites, they have, like, whole things about it. But there is somebody that lives there now and has lived there for a very long time. So, you know, even all the paranormal sites are like, please don't... go and like, we know that it's famous now because of like A Haunting in Connecticut and everything, but it's like, please don't go and like take pictures of this lady's house and shit like that. It's a nice looking house, I gotta say. It's kind of like colonial looking, and it's really, really big. Cause I looked it up on Zillow after I figured out what the address was, and it's actually 5-bedroom, 2-bath, and it's over 3,000 square feet. I think it's like 3,084 square feet or something. So it's a big place, like when you see it, and it's really, really nice. So, like I said, I'm not necessarily going to say what the address is, but you can find it super easy. I found it in like 2 minutes, and I found pictures of the house and everything, like the real one. So she apparently sees the for rent sign outside. She goes in, and she said the inside was being renovated. So there was like a work crew, but they let her in to see it. And she's like, oh my God, this place is gorgeous and it's gigantic. And like I said, they needed kind of a big place because, you know, they have a whole shit ton of kids. And she's like, so I looked at it and she's like, there's no way we're going to be able to afford this shit because it's like massive. But she really loved it. And she said it was like only a couple minutes away from the hospital. So and she even went down in the basement and looked and said, oh, this would be perfect for like the boy's bedroom, like the, you know, the one that had cancer and like the younger brother. And she's like, basically, it seemed too good to be true. Now, she brings Ed, her husband, to see it. And he also thinks it's amazing. But then when they go down to look at the basement, they see some shit that Karen didn't see before. Now, her story was, I don't think they said this on A Haunting, but I know this because I looked it up later. She said that when she first went down to the basement, she saw like the basement part but because they were, the construction crew were there, they were like working on it, and she said there was a bunch of construction shit like in front of this other door, because there's like another room like in the basement, and so she couldn't go in there, or she didn't see the door or whatever, so she didn't see it when she was in there. So when her and Ed come back to look at it, and she, and he's like, yeah, man, this place is like really awesome, but they go down to the basement, and then there's like a room in the back that she hadn't noticed before, hadn't looked into before. So they go in there, and at first they don't really know what they're looking at. They said there was like all this stuff in there. There's like a metal gurney. There was like some bone saws. There's like the whole pump thingy that has like the formaldehyde in it or whatever. And it's like at first they're like, what is all this shit? And I'm just like, do you guys not like know anything about like dead people? Or I don't know. I guess not. But there's like they weren't kids.
One of them was a teenager, right?
No, I'm talking about the adults.
Oh, the adults.
The mom and
okay.
dad.
Okay.
The mom and dad.
You're right. I was thinking of the images in the fucking program where they go down there and they're playing in there. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, no, that's they're not even there yet.
Okay.
So they're talking about, yeah. There was even like a big walk-in freezer down there, and then that's when Karen said, oh shit, that's a morgue. This was a mortuary. Yeah. Now, I don't know if I want to say this right now, because that's one detail that has changed from telling to telling, like when Carmen Snedeker tells it, because she likes to say, in some interviews, that she didn't know that it was a mortuary until later, like after they'd already paid like first and last, and after they were already like moving in, and then she got like really upset. But then in other interviews that I've seen or read with her, she said, oh, they knew, and like the realtor came forward and said, no, they absolutely knew, we told them ahead of time, because that's just kind of what you do. She's like, the whole family knew like before they moved in.
I remember also hearing some stuff that was from the owner of the house, and he said that all the mortuary stuff was gone out of it.
Well, see, that was one weird thing about it, is that why I can see leaving some of the stuff that couldn't be moved, like if there was a big ass freezer or something like that, but why would you leave little shit like bone saws and like a metal gurney? It's like, why would you leave that if you were gonna rent it out? It seems like it'd be really easy to get rid of it.
A lot of stuff came out over the years, and I remember that on one of these shows, the guy that owned the place was on one of those daytime talk shows, and he was saying, no. But he says, all the stuff that they're talking about, all the mortuary stuff, was long gone. That they did renovations and everything.
That's what I'm saying. Why? Right. Like, and she said, too, that, like, when they moved in, they said they were working, they renovated all the inside.
Yeah.
So it's like, why would they just leave all this stuff in the basement? It doesn't make any sense to
me. No. I kind of believe that the owner of the building that, okay, maybe it was a mortuary. That part checked out. But they are
It
adding,
was a mortuary,
So that checks out. But all this stuff about them leaving bone saws and gurneys,
that doesn't make sense.
Because it had been renovated to be turned into a house for rent.
Right.
So they would have made sure to get all that. And that's basically what the owner said. He says, no, none of that was in there. So it's not a sign that the case is fake per se, it's a sign that they're exaggerating shit to make the case fucking sound scarier than it was.
Yeah. Because that would be scary if you moved into a house that you didn't know was a funeral home and then went down to the basement. It's like, oh my God, there's all this funeral homey shit down here.
Because the owner was in the audience of one of them, and I think it might have been Donahue. And Donahue fucking stood and goes, yeah. And he stood up, and Donahue was talking to him, goes, I own that building. And he goes, no. He goes, all that stuff was gone. Because you couldn't tell that it was a mortuary.
Yeah, why would you rent it out like with all that crap still in there?
I think it said it had like an elevator that was kind of like a dumbwaiter that you could move a body from downstairs to upstairs. It says that was there.
Well, yeah, but that's something you can't easily remove.
Yeah, it says that was there. But I think, you know, this has been a long time, people, okay? But I think he said that it had been sealed off so you really couldn't see it. You know what I mean? Because it has doors.
Right.
That had been kind of that the elevator was there, but it had been covered up, so you couldn't see that it was there. And I think maybe that there was like a walk-in refrigerator.
Yeah, they did show that it had a walk-in freezer.
Yeah,
and at least on the show, they kind of showed it like it was built in, so like you couldn't
move it.
Yeah,
it was like a room.
It. But yeah, so I'm I'm assuming obviously they would leave that there, but. Yeah, other stuff, like, why would you leave little shit, like bone saws and, you know, the, what?
What are you talking about? Cat's on his back, and she said something.
She's laying there like this on her back.
Yeah. Yeah.
She said.
So, Akon, I'm going to go with the owner of the building. He was just kind of smirking and shaking his head at the Snedekers going, you guys are full of shit. You know what I mean?
Well, see, that's what... And yeah. Like I said, I do like this episode, and I like this... It's a cool story.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that that's... My Spidey senses are immediately just kind of like, why would they leave shit like that in the house if they were going to rent it out to somebody?
Yeah, the owner said they made extra care to fucking... try to kind of erase the fact
that's what I mean. It's like, obviously, if I owned the place and I said, oh, okay, I'm gonna rent this out to like regular people, it's like nobody wants to know that shit used to like have all dead bodies in it all the time.
Yeah,
so you'd want to like paint over everything and like fucking you'd want to get rid of everything that said that. Ghost you wouldn't leave all that stuff in there.
Ghostface is bringing up said that the neighbor that lived across the street of the Snedekers was a fucking looky-loo that would watch him with binoculars and even write down fucking shit in on pen and paper. I remember her and fucking the crowd turned against her like, who are you fucking watching these people and fucking writing it down? And fucking she was embarrassed, but she was like trying to that particular neighbor was doing everything she could to try to make the to debunk this case. That's what she was trying to do.
I kind of remember that.
Yeah, that it didn't happen, that they were lying.
Yeah, and like I said, I hate to like call people out like and say that they're making stuff up, but some of the stuff doesn't seem like all that logical to me.
Yeah, but that neighbor fucking seemed like a whack job herself. Why did she care so much?
That's another thing. Like she binoculars might have been crazy
and shit.
Too.
Yeah, she was fucking crazy too.
Yeah, who would fucking do that?
I wouldn't give a fuck if they were lying about across the street or not. Yeah, they're lying across the street. I gotta stop this.
Yeah, it's like why? Get a hobby. Yeah. I mean, get a different hobby.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I don't give a fuck if they're lying across the street.
That's what I mean. I don't give a fuck what my neighbors are doing unless it's like a serial killer or some shit. Then but
if they're lying
or making like a fuck ton of noise, then other than that, I don't give a crap what they're doing over there. So they see all this stuff and they're like, oh my god, this was a mortuary, and she gets really upset. But Ed is like, well, you know, it's fine. It'll be fine. Like, nobody actually died in here. There's just, I'm just like, well, it's a little semantics
you
there.
You just took
like,
dead people in
here. You just took dead. There's just, like, been lots of dead people in here. It's like, nobody actually died here, though. Like, that makes a difference. I don't know. But yeah, it's like,
I'm
obviously.
I'm going to say one thing, though.
What?
I've seen some news reports on mortuaries and, like, funeral homes that were going out of business and badly mismanaged that were fucking, one of them was outside of fucking Detroit. Fucking crazy. There were dead bodies unburied still in there, and some of them had been in there for fucking years.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
Hidden up in the dam, underneath the dam ceiling tiles, were fucking big old shoe boxes of like 20 unburied babies that were just up in there mummified. And the guy who ran the place was just some crackhead who would take the body, and if he never really got payment on time, he'd just fucking say fuck it. You know what I mean? And then he abandoned it, and when they went in there, there were like fucking 30 unburied, uncremated bodies still in there in different stages of decomposition. And some of them had been embalmed, and some of them hadn't, and it was just, man, fucking bad. And the place had been abandoned for like years before people went in there and found all that shit. Which is weird, I guess, because the relatives were low income and they're like, oh, well, we didn't really pay for any of this cremation or anything. So they didn't really care what happened to the bodies and they were just still in there. That shit's on YouTube. You can find it. I can imagine that, though. This place was not a place like that, though. But it was just bad shit can't happen in these fucking places.
I think the name of it originally, I think it was Hallahan Funeral Home, something like that. I looked it up like when I was researching the book. I think it was Hallahan.
Yeah, not a highly regulated industry, surprisingly. Nobody cares.
Why is that surprising? I'm not surprised.
Yeah. They don't really care what you do with these dead bodies.
Yeah, it's like, just don't leave them on my lawn, that's all.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Stink up the place. But yeah, so... Obviously, that's why this house was so cheap, because, like I said, it's big. I looked it up on Zillow. It's a big house. It's over 3,000 square feet and 5-bedroom. So, and they were getting it. They didn't say how much the rent was, but they said it was super cheap. Although, I will note, the last time this sold, and I'm assuming that the same woman lives there now, she bought it in 1998, and she bought it for $140,000.
Hmm.
And it's a massive, and it's nice. Like I said, yeah. I've seen pictures of it. But I'm assuming she still lives there, or she still owns it, because it hasn't been bought since 1998, right. At least according to Zillow. So she either still lives there, or she's renting it out. I don't really know, to somebody else. Because I was curious, so I looked it up. But so...
Somebody said it was 60 fetuses buried in the ceiling. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Let's see, where was I? Okay, all right, so... Basically, Karen's like, okay, well, I don't like living in what used to be a funeral home, but, you know, I know we can't move. We've already spent all our money, and otherwise, the house is perfect. Like, it's right close to the hospital. It's big enough for everybody, yada, yada. So they agree that they're not going to tell the kids about it, though. Karen said especially she didn't want her son, the one that had cancer, thinking about death all the time, especially because he's going through all the treatments and everything. But there was also a cemetery, like, right... I don't know if it's right next to the house, but it was, like, really, really close to the house, you know, obviously, which makes sense. So they figured, well, it's probably going to be really hard to, like, hide the house's past from them. And I'm assuming that the neighbors probably knew that it was a funeral home, too. And I kind of figure if the kids go to school, like, somebody's going to tell them. So, but, you know, they didn't really want to tell the kids. Now, at this point, the realtor... They said got rid of all the embalming equipment. I said you would think that they would have done that before they moved in, but whatever. Some of the larger stuff, like the freezer and everything, got left. Like I said, stuff that they couldn't really move. Like I said, I don't know why they didn't move it prior to them moving in, but whatever. Now, the first thing that happened, like before they even brought their furniture in, at least according to Karen, that's what I'm calling her, even though her name's Carmen. She was apparently mopping the kitchen floor, and the mop water... turned like deep red and thick, she said, like blood. And she's like mopping the floor, and so it looks like she's mopping blood everywhere. Now, so like first she thought that she was like ruining the floor or something was wrong with the floor, like, you know what I mean? But yeah, she said it looked like blood, and she said, I think her quote was, it made my skin crawl. That's what she said. So it was just kind of like all this blood, like all fucked up. So, at this point, the son...
I think I heard somebody... Okay.
Oh.
Yeah, I thought I heard somebody at the door. Hold on one second. I'll go check.
Yeah, we might have got packages. Yeah. I got all my packages and shit like that coming. So, the son goes down to the basement for the first time. Because I think what ended up happening was that the dad was being transferred. Like, because like I said, they were from upstate New York. So, he had his company transfer him to Connecticut. But it was taking a while. So they didn't all move in at the same time. It's kind of like Carmen went first, you know, with one of the kid, with the kid that had cancer, who we're calling Paul here. But, you know, so they could go to his appointments. But the other kids and the dad, like, were still back in the thing. And then they would come later. And then I think, too, that, like, the dad, he didn't... he had a thing where he still had to work in upstate New York, like, before the transfer came through. So he was, like, only coming down on weekends, like, to say, for, like, a little while. So they get into that a little bit. So the son, Paul, goes down into the basement for the first time, which is going to be his room. Like, it's going to be his room and his brother Bobby, who's 2 years younger, who's 12, I guess. And he said when he first went down there, well, he didn't say because he wasn't on the show, said that he felt like really icy cold and also like somebody was watching him from the room where all the embalming stuff had been. I don't know what it looked like in real life, but in the show, it was kind of like they had this big space, like the basement, and then there was like a double door that had like glass panes in it. And then in there was like where all the mortuary was. In real life, though, I don't think the basement was the embalming room from everything that I could determine. Because like I said, I wrote about this in my book and I did a lot of research about it. I thought from what I could determine that the basement had actually been the place where they, like the casket display room. So I don't think they were like doing embalming or nothing like that in the basement. Unless I'm wrong. But I think like the room where they were, where the two boys were sleeping wasn't actually the embalming room. It was actually like just where the caskets were displayed. But I could be totally wrong about that. But that was my understanding from everything that I read about the layout of the original funeral home.
We got the mail too.
Oh, okay.
Cat treats.
Yeah.
Okay. I got that chicken in there thawing.
Oh, okay.
Get some chicken thighs.
Yeah, that'll be good.
All right.
Yeah, Danny Rowling said, I think the cancer came back and killed the son off in real life. It did. He died in 2012. I mean, it did go into remission. Like, he did actually, like, grow up and get married and have kids and stuff. But it did come back, and he died later on. So he goes down there, and he goes back upstairs, and he sees, like, the creaky door, like, the basement door opens by itself, and hears somebody calling his name. So he immediately runs to his mom. His mom said he was scared to death, and he's like, basically, I don't like it here, we gotta leave. Now, his mom is like, well, maybe it's just because he's so close to death himself because of the cancer that he could, like, sense it was a funeral home because they apparently hadn't told him. But she doesn't actually believe that he heard an actual voice. But just in case, she brings in the Catholic priest that married her and her husband and has him do some kind of, like, healing thing, voodoo, on the son. Now, shortly after that, the rest of the kids move in. Now, the one of the other sons, who they call Bobby, like I said, I think his real name is Bradley, if I'm not mistaken. He was 2 years younger, so he was 12. And the two of them are really close. Now, this guy actually is the real guy, is on the show, like, in shadow. He's the only one of the Snedeker kids that came onto this show. Although the niece actually does show up later on. So the two of them are going to be sharing the basement room. Now, Paul, the older son, has found out about the funeral home situation somehow. Like I said, you know, it seemed like it wasn't really a big secret or anything. And he told the younger son all about it, even though the parents told him not to. So he said that the first thing was that, you know, he would kind of, like, tease him about it, and he even, like, made him get up on the morgue gurney, like, without telling him what it was, and, like, spun him around on it and shit like that. And he said that was, like, really creepy and, like, scared him really bad, like, once he found out what it was, right? Even though, again, it seems like the realtor said they took out all the stuff, like, after, why would the morgue gurney still be in there? Why would you leave that for the family? They're not going to need a morgue gurney, I would hope.
Yeah, the owner and landlord said all that stuff is gone.
Yeah, and like I said, that makes more sense to me. Yeah. That makes more sense to me. So Karen and the kids are in the house largely on their own for a while until, as I mentioned, Ed's transfer came through. So he would only be there on the weekends. Now, one day, their one daughter, who they call Connie on the show, I'm not entirely sure, I don't remember what her real name is, but she seemed kind of little. She was maybe like 7 or something like that. And she apparently saw a woman in her room looking at her and ran to tell her mom about it. So Karen says she was actually trembling when she told her about it. And Karen said this was really unusual because, you know, this wasn't a kid that was like real skittish or scared of everything. So the fact that she was like freaking out so much, you know, was like really unusual. So Karen obviously goes to the room and obviously doesn't see anything. Now, Karen figures, she's like, well, it must have been that Paul, the oldest son, told all the other kids that the place was a funeral home, and now they're, like, fucking with the daughter, like, they're playing tricks on her and, like, trying to scare her, you know what I mean?
How old was the daughter again?
I'm not sure. She looked, in the show, the actress looked like she was about 7-ish.
Okay.
She looked like she was the youngest.
Okay.
You know what I mean? I can't remember. I think maybe she was 7 or 8, right, if I'm remembering correctly. But yeah, so Karen accuses the boys of, like, you know, will you please stop playing tricks on your sister? And they insist that they didn't tell her that it was a funeral home and they weren't playing tricks on her or anything. Now, meanwhile, in the basement, the two boys are seeing what at first appears to be somebody moving around behind the door to the other room. Because remember how I said that it was like a double door with like glass panes? And they said at first they were like, they would lay there in bed and look at it like in the dark, and they thought it was just like shadows from outside or something. But they said the more that he looked at it, it looked like a person like walking around in there, and it was like freaking him out. And so they started like not wanting to sleep in the basement anymore. So they would go up and like camp out in the living room. And basically their mom came down and was like, what the fuck are you kids like doing in the living room? And they said, there's a guy in the basement. And she's like, yeah, whatever, bullshit. I was like, if there really was a guy in the basement, we'll make him pay rent or something like that. Like, she didn't believe, like, anything they said. She thought that they were all just, like, full of shit. Both the brothers insisted that they saw the person, though, and he was, like, moving around behind the door. Now, Karen was kind of hoping that all of this nonsense would end once Ed arrived there for the weekend. But while, like, before he got there, though, like, she asked one of the other kids, Bobby, to go down to the basement freezer to bring up some bread, because they had a bunch of stuff down in the freezer, which, I guess that had bodies in it. And they're like, okay, we're using that to put food in. I mean, I'm sure they cleaned it, but But still, okay. So the kid didn't want to go down there because he was like wigged out. But he goes down there kind of reluctantly. Meanwhile, while he's kind of creeping around down in the basement, Karen, and she said this happened more than once. Like, I think they only showed it once on the show. But I think, like, when I read some stuff about it later, she said that it happened more than once. Karen sets the table for breakfast, and then she goes to take, like, get some shit out of the oven or whatever. And then when she turns around, like, back to the dining room, the table isn't set, and the dishes are back in the cupboard. She said that was, like, pretty common, that happened a lot. And she was like, I just thought I was going crazy. She's like, I know that I set that table, and, you know. And then I turned around and the dishes weren't there anymore. So Bobby is down in the old morgue and apparently hears a voice calling his brother's name. He called it on the show, the real guy, he said he called it a deep, grimy voice. And then he just had his hand like on the door of the freezer. And then he hears that and he just like nopes the fuck out. He's like, nope. So Karen goes down with him to get the bread. And of course she doesn't see or hear anything. Now Karen still doesn't believe the kids, thinking it's just their imaginations. Bobby said that him and his older brother, it's like, we always knew the house was haunted from the time that we moved in. We never thought we were crazy. We always knew there was something in there. So we just kind of like kept it to ourselves though. After a while, Karen also said she started like teasing Bobby about the voice, like, ooh, like, oh, it was so scary and shit like that. Like, so she said she felt bad later on, but you know what I mean? So at breakfast, like, Ed finally gets there for the weekend, and Karen and Ed finally break down and admit to all the kids that the house used to be a funeral home. Now, at this point, Paul tells his dad about the man in the basement, and Bobby, like, backs him up on it. Yeah, there's really a guy, like, walking around in there, but Ed, of course, doesn't believe them either. And he says to Paul, hey, you're the oldest, and you need to, like, set a good example and stop telling the other kids ghost stories because you're scaring them, and it's like, you know, you're making their imaginations run wild or whatever. Bobby also said that Paul had changed a lot after the cancer diagnosis, which, I mean, you know, that stands to reason. He's a 14-year-old kid. He's maybe dying of cancer. And so he's not going to be like a bundle of joy, you know what I mean? Or like be like super cheerful. I get that. But there was also a lot of stress in the family, too, just because of how much money it was costing. So that was like taking a toll also. Now, Karen and Ed, at this point, they still kind of think maybe that Paul, like, seeing things, maybe that's, like, a side effect of his medication, or maybe his mental health is deteriorating, like, in light of his cancer diagnosis, which, like I said, wouldn't be all that surprising. But the thing about it, though, is that Karen also noticed some weird shit happening in the house also. One of the minor things that she noticed was all the crucifixes would disappear from the walls. And she would never be able to find them. Like, they would disappear, like, one by one. So there was a bunch of crucifixes, like, all over the... Because, like I said, it used to be a funeral home. So they'd be, like, over the doors and whatnot. And I think they showed this more in Paranormal Witness. Like, they leaned more into this. They just mentioned it on here a couple times. But she said, like, you know, there'd be one, like, on the back of a door or something. And then suddenly she'd be walking through and be like, hey, where the fuck did that go? And then, like, it's not there anymore. You know what I mean? So after a while, the boys in the basement started seeing even more apparitions. Bobby described it as four guys in dark clothes, and they were like whispering to one another, and says that he saw them like picking things up and like looking through papers. Like they were in the corner of the basement room, like around a table or something. The first time that they saw this, they ran upstairs and woke up their parents. But of course, like when the parents came down, there was nobody there. Ed goes all around the house checking the doors and the windows. He even goes outside and he's like, there's no way nobody could have gotten in. Like it was snowing outside. There were no footprints in the snow. It's like there can't be anybody in here. And at this point, their dad is like getting super pissed off and he's just like losing his patience because like you bitches keep waking me up in the middle of the fucking night. And, you know, and I come down here and there's nothing in there. And the kids are going to kind of get more and more upset that they aren't believed. And the boys start sleeping with all the lights on. And they said that we would tell the other two siblings, like, what happened, too, because Connie also saw some shit. I think the other kid that they called Mark in this, I don't think he ever saw anything, but the other three did. And, so they would, like, tell each other all the time just so they would know that they weren't crazy, like, that there was other people they could talk to about it. So Karen actually asks Paul's oncologist, like, at his next appointment, if his medications could be causing hallucinations. But the doctor said, no, that's not one of the side effects. So then Karen thinks that maybe Paul is having mental health problems on top of the cancer, which, you know, is a little bit alarming because the family is already up to their eyeballs in medical bills. And along those lines, they get an electric bill, and the dad sees it, and he is, like, really pissed off because he's like, this electric bill is ridiculously high, and he attributes it to the boys keeping their fucking lights, all the lights on in the basement, like, all the time because they're scared. So he goes down into the base, even though to me it seems like just having a few lights on, like light, because light bulbs don't really use all that much power. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I kind of feel like that's not what's making your electric bill that high, dude. I'm like, maybe you should check like your fridge or your other wiring or some shit like that, because
there was a problem.
Or your heating bill. Yeah, it's not light bulbs, I'm telling you right now. It's
I noticed
very
that was kind of a common complaint about these haunted house type deals, is that, you know what I mean, the power is getting sucked up mysteriously.
Yeah.
I always kind of think that maybe there might have been some copycat type situation every now and then in these stories.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, because it seems to kind of come and go. Like, that was like an 80s thing.
Yeah.
And no matter what we did, you know what I mean, the power bill was going crazy.
Yeah. So maybe it was that, but it's just like that was another thing too that really didn't, that kind of like, I know it was like a minor thing, but why would you think if the electric bill was indeed like way, way higher than usual, I would not jump to attributing that to, oh, my sons are keeping like a couple extra light bulbs burning all night. That would absolutely not make your electric bill go up that much.
Right.
I mean, that's not
one of the, back then.
No, that's not one of the main appliances that causes like your electric bill to be high. Like I said, you want to look more at like your air conditioning heating system, your refrigerator, like your big appliances. Little light bulbs aren't going to do it.
Yeah, and in the 80s, power was cheap.
Right.
Yeah.
I was kind of like wondering because they showed, well, they actually on the show, they showed the electric bill and it said it was like $386 or something like that. And I said, that's about right for a house that size, I would think. But I mean, not in the 80s, but nowadays that's about right.
Yeah,
because that house,
depending on what state you're in,
well, that house was about the same size as this one, you know what I mean, like more or less. And that's usually
about right.
that's about right that's about what our electric bill is. So
running two central air conditioners,
and that's running two central air conditioners
during summer.
But I mean, back in 1986, that was a lot, I guess. But yeah, so basically, he thinks, oh, the electric bill, it's like you bitches running the lights all the time. So he goes down to the basement and takes out all of the light bulbs, like, oh, the overhead lights. He just leaves them like one little lamp, like on their bedside table. And they're just like, no, because like I said, they were so scared and everything. So he goes in there and takes all the bulbs out. Now that night, it seems like, they're sleeping and they're kind of freaking out because there's only one light, and they hear the door creaking, and then they hear a girl giggling, and then their overhead lights start going off and on even though there aren't any bulbs in there.
Oh, yeah.
which they were like weirded out, but they're like, what the fuck?
That's pretty wild.
Dad came down here and took all the bulbs out.
Yeah.
So then they look over and they see their sister Connie standing on the basement stairs, flipping the light switch up and down, like turn the light on, turn the light off, turn the light on, turn the light off. And then they're like, what? And they're like looking over there. And then Connie then turns around and runs up the stairs. So Bobby like runs after her. But when he gets up there, his parents, who are still up, they say, Connie's been upstairs in bed for hours and she hasn't come by here. Like, we haven't seen her. We would have seen her like come by the base to go down to the basement. So Bobby goes upstairs and sees Connie indeed sound asleep in her bed. So Bobby's like freaked out, thinking, oh, well, this evil entity or whatever it is in the house is now like impersonating members of my family. So that's like a little alarming that it can do that, right? That was actually my favorite scene, I think, just because how freaky would it be, like, to, one, like, the lights are coming on and there's no bulbs, and then you look over and see, like, a family member just sitting there going, dead, 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 like that, and then, like, you turn and then they're, like, not there. That would be, like, really, really freaky. So, at this point, Paul has stopped bothering talking to his parents since they never believe him, anything he says. He decides that he's going to confront the voice that keeps calling him, which is never a good idea in these episodes. So he goes back into the morgue room, and the program shows, like, a guy with black eyes, like, in a suit, like, looking evilly at Paul, which I'm guessing is the manifestation of the demon or whatever. Now, apparently, this is akin to what he saw, because he did call it, in real life, the man in the suit. So that's what he called it. So that's what they showed it as. Now, after that, Paul starts turning into a teenager. Meaning, he starts, like, listening to, like, blasting loud rock music, wearing black, becoming more quiet and reserved, pulling away from his family, shit like that. Which, like I said, is not all that weird, but whatever. He also insisted that he needed his own room, man. So Bobby has to move out the basement. And he says that him and his brother, who had been very, very close prior to this time, kind of became alienated after that as he got, like, all brooding and teenager-y, like I said.
Started drawing weird pictures.
Yeah, he started and doing, like, writing poems about necrophilia and shit
like
that.
Yeah, I remember in one of the programs, I think they showed the actual things that he was drawing. It was pretty good. Or at least supposedly it was what he was actually drawing.
Yeah.
But it wasn't in any of these documentaries. I think it was on one of those talk shows that they showed.
Yeah, I don't. I kind of vaguely remember that, but...
Yeah, it was pretty weird.
Yeah. So, Paul's cancer actually goes into remission soon after that. And it seemed like they didn't really hammer this home too hard, but I think they were trying to draw a parallel between his mental health or his demonic kind of shit, like, taking over, but then, like, his physical health getting better. Because they said his cancer went into remission after that. But he was just kind of like, yeah, whatever. You know what I mean? He was very teenager-y about it. Now, not too long after this, Karen actually invites her 17-year-old niece, Teresa. That's what they called her on the show. Her real name is actually Tammy. To stay with them while her parents are going through a divorce. Now, when Teresa gets there, like, everybody's all super jazzed to see her, but Paul stays in the basement. Now, she said that her and Paul had always been really good friends, so she was kind of like, you know, why isn't he up here to see me? But Karen was kind of hoping that having her around would, like, help bring him back to normal. So Teresa goes down to the basement to see him, but she said that she immediately noticed the difference in him. She said he looked, he sounded angry and, like, he was getting mean. And he told her about, like, seeing and hearing things and saying that his parents didn't believe him. He said things were getting worse and he felt really isolated and alone. And he said whatever this thing was always talking to him and wouldn't ever leave him alone. And it told him to do bad things to his family because his family sucked and hated him and, like, deserved to get killed or whatever. So Teresa said that he had this really weird look in his eyes. It was, like, unlike him. So she kind of, like, thought he was possessed, I guess. Teresa also said when she moved into the house, I was like, kind of poor, it's a poor girl, because it's like she moves out her regular house because her parents were going through a divorce and were, like, screaming at each other all the time. And then she's like moves into this house and now these people are screaming at each other all the time. She's like, I'm just going to go sleep in a car or, like, in a bus station. I'm sure it'd be, like, much quieter. But yeah, so there's that. But yeah, they said the family was fighting all the time because Paul was, like, acting out of control. She said, too, that Paul got to a point where he wouldn't even leave the basement because, according to him, I guess, like, the demon was constantly telling him to go upstairs and do shit to his family, so he was either choosing to stay down there so he wouldn't kill them, or the demon was making him stay down there. I'm not really sure which of those two things is the case. So Teresa, then, she feels kind of bad about going behind Paul's back and, like, narking on him, essentially, but she's, like, she was really worried about him, so she goes to the mom and tells the mom about all the stuff that Paul said, and she said, well, he feels like this is a demon, like the man in the suit, and it's, like, controlling him. Now, Karen, again, is not really believing the shit and said, well, maybe it's just because of the cancer. He became, like, obsessed with death and all this morbid stuff or whatever. And Paul had also said, I guess, that the demon threatened to do things to him if he didn't do what he was told. And he said that he saw, like, dead people in the basement all the time, shit like that. Now, he also, at one point, like, he started to kind of get violent toward Teresa. He was trying to spin her around in the gurney, kind of, like, you know, pushing her around and stuff, and chased her up the basement stairs. And then she said after that, she didn't really trust him anymore. And the other kids were scared of him also, because they said that he got real unpredictable and, you know, he would just, like, get mad at the drop of a hat and, like, you never really knew what he was going to do. So everybody just kind of, like, avoided him because, you know, like I said, he was kind of scary. So at this point, Teresa starts wearing these rosary beads that Karen gave her, like, for protection or whatever, which kind of factors into the plot later on. So at this point, you know, Karen decides she's going to take Paul to a psychiatrist who was very concerned about his behavior and suggested further therapy. Karen agreed to this, but seemed, the show said, it was already too late. In real life, he was actually diagnosed with schizophrenia, but they did not mention that on the show, but that I found that out later on. Now, soon after this, Paul goes into Teresa's room in the middle of the night and basically stood at the end and was like pulling the covers off her. And then he jumped on top of her, and it looked as though he was, like, trying to rape her. They didn't say that on the show, but that's pretty clearly what they were implying. So, basically, Bobby, the other brother, was like, yeah, he just went totally off the deep end. He was, like, getting really violent. So, at this point, like, Karen calls an ambulance, and they came and took Paul away. They put him in a hospital. Like I said, he was diagnosed with schizophrenia later on. So they said that he was like crying when they took him away, like asking, where are you taking me? Like, blah, blah, blah. As they were taking him away, at least according to the mom, Paul said to his parents, well, now that I'm out of the house, they'll be after you. That's what he said. So it seemed to be like he was warning them that like, oh, all the demons are going to like get after you now because I'm not here anymore. So at this point, Karen is still not believing that there's any nefarious shit going on in this house and is convinced that Paul has completely lost his mind and will probably never be normal again. So he essentially gets committed. You know what I mean? He gets put in the hospital. In real life, I don't know. Like I said, the timelines on these are kind of like squirrely. They never really tell you. He was in there for like a month and a half, I think. And like I said, they did diagnose him with schizophrenia, at least as far as I could determine. So there's that. Now, so when Ed and Karen got home, Karen goes to drop the keys in this. Remember how I said, like, they had, like, the crucifixes and shit like that, like, all over the doors and everything? They had, like, by the door, there was this little, I don't know, I'm not a churchy person, so I don't know what the fuck, little baptismal font kind of situation.
Yeah, some,
that had, like, a
the holy water
crucifix
thing.
Over it, that had, like, a little hole, did you, like, dip your fingers in it or whatever?
Yeah.
Okay, well, they had one of those in the house, and she'd been, like, putting her keys in it, I guess.
Yeah.
And so she comes in and goes
wash
in there
the
to,
keys off.
Yeah, to wash. Well, no, there was no water in it, but it's, yeah, like, it used to have water in it. So so she goes in there to drop the keys, and she notices it's gone. It's just completely, like, disappeared off the wall. So she's like, okay, that was weird. And, like, it wasn't on the floor or nothing. They never did find it, apparently. And what?
Yeah, I grabbed her feet.
She's like, don't touch my feet, Daddy. You know better.
She doesn't like me touching her feet.
Well, yeah, most cats don't
surprised
like that.
Surprised you with touching the feet, yeah.
Yeah, she's like, she's like, I'm going to bite you, bitch. Don't even.
Yeah.
She will bite you
if you fucking do that
eventually. She doesn't bite hard, though.
Yeah, no.
She knows she doesn't want to hurt you. She's just, it's a warning. But yeah, so she tries to tell Ed, she's like, hey, bro, like, the thing is gone from the wall where you usually put the keys. Isn't that weird? And he's just like, I don't want to hear about it. You know what I mean? Because our son just got committed and whatnot. Now, so basically, at this point, it had been, like, a long night. I guess it's, like, 4 or 5 in the morning. And Ed is just kind of like, he has to go to work. And he has to leave for work not too long after that. Now, meanwhile, Karen, she's still at home, and she goes down to the basement to sit because she's wondering now, hey, maybe Paul wasn't crazy after all. I'm like, well, it's a little late to be thinking that now that you haven't committed. So she goes down to the basement, sits on the steps, and she's, like, waiting for something to happen. She said she was hoping that she would see something so it would be, like, definitive that her son wasn't crazy. And she said it was really cold down there, like, freezing cold, and she said she felt fearful, but she didn't really see anything as much as she wanted to. She basically, like, dared the thing to show itself, whatever it was, but nothing happened, so she was kind of, like, ambivalent about it. Also at home, Teresa is asleep, and her rosary beads, like, pick themselves up, kinda, and, like, they start moving around her neck like that. And then Karen goes, meanwhile, she goes in the shower, like, to take a shower. They showed this on Paranormal Witness, too. And then, like, I get the shower curtain, like, pulls tight around her like it's going to suffocate her. And she can't get out, you know?
Yeah.
So they showed that. So she's, like, screaming and shit. And then Teresa also has the covers pulled off her. And she hears her aunt screaming, so she runs in there and helps her. And they have to, like, pull it or, like, cut her out of the shit or whatever. And then at this point they realize, oh, maybe there is something evil in the house after all.
This must have been where they left out the part where the supernatural force was molesting the.
I think they did include that in the Paranormal Witness one.
Yeah.
But it wasn't really on here. All they showed on here was her rosary beads, like, being picked up off her neck, and then it showed, like, the covers coming off by themselves.
In the daytime talk shows, what was described probably around this time, you know, or at least this time or sometime after, she ran in, what was it, Miss Snedeker ran in to see the niece in bed, and she saw a fucking hand an invisible hand underneath her blouse. There was a nightshirt or something. Go up, she could see the knuckles on it, and it was grabbing her around the breast and stuff. And she started trying to fight with it and hold her down, but there was no way she could protect her from it. She could see hands fucking underneath the dam, her clothes. It's a creepy story from what she said. You know, and the girl tried to roll over and protect herself from it, and the fucking hand thing would just vanish and come back somewhere else. And I think she said she saw it come out and then move across space, but vanish. That'd be weird. Just a disembodied hand.
Yeah, I think I remember them saying that. That's all we need is a fucking handsy-ass ghost.
Came out from underneath her and fucking moved a few feet and just faded away. Which, that was kind of a weird description of
they didn't
maybe could have happened.
They didn't mention that on this. Yeah, like I said, basically all they showed was like the covers being pulled off and the rosary beads like being picked up and stuff. Yeah. So maybe they were trying to go for like a more family friendly vibe, so they didn't really want to like do any of the more sexual stuff on the show.
From what I remember, she said it was just kind of a disembodied hand. She could see the wrist, and it was just kind of a bony Caucasian hand that went down past the wrist a few inches and just kind of, you know what I mean? But it was moving fast. She couldn't see it real clearly. But she said when it was underneath the clothes, she could see the impression of the knuckles and the fingers and stuff going underneath her down. Grip there and grab some of that titty meat.
Titty meat.
Titty meat.
That's the 17-year-old girl you're talking about.
I know.
Don't be creepy.
Well, I got titty meat. Fucking pounds and pounds of it. But no, it's just weird. That's spooky.
It is kind of spooky. Especially, that would be really spooky if that happened to you.
And because of, you know, my experience at Mammoth Mountain, fucking with that poltergeist, this sounded plausible. I didn't see anything like that. I saw stuff like that, but not that. I could imagine that the poltergeist that I saw could replicate that. I don't know where they got that. Maybe she did see that. I don't know. But they cut it out. They cut it out of other stories. They didn't want
either that, or they hadn't established that detail of the story yet. Like, maybe they didn't add that detail until later.
No, I heard that early on. Well, it was still in the 80s. Early on.
So maybe that
omitted later.
Maybe the makers of A Haunting were like, "Yeah, we don't want to put too much of the sexual stuff in there because
maybe she was underage. Maybe so they were afraid to talk about that. I don't know.
Yeah, it might have been that too. Because, like I said, they didn't do any of the ghost butt working either.
Right.
They didn't talk about any of that.
I think that happened to Miss Snedeker. I think.
And the dad too. I think it happened to the dad, and I think it happened to the niece. Well, so they said. Allegedly.
Ghost going anal, man. On men and women.
Well, you know.
That's right. That's the dad. The dad also said that, I think.
Yeah.
That's some weird
shit. Did they get that from the Smurl case? Because I kind of feel like the same. Now, so the Smurl case, that was the one with the pigs, right? With the pig people?
I don't remember. That's been so long. I don't remember that one exactly.
I kind of feel like we should do a show about the Smurl haunting at some point. Like, I put it in the poll a couple times. I can't believe we haven't done one. Maybe we did, and I just don't remember. We've done so many fucking shows. I can't even remember what fucking show we've talked about when we haven't. But, yeah. So, meanwhile, Ed, the dad, is at work, and he's in his office, and his truck apparently starts itself up and drives through his office. This seems like it would be something that would be like fairly easy to check because that's like a big deal, but it's like I don't know if that really happened or not. But he said that the truck started up and drove through his office. So while this is going on at his work, wherever that is, back at the house, the phone rings and then Karen picks it up and then she hears a girl giggling. And so then Karen and Teresa are sitting at the kitchen table freaking out because, like I said, you know, Teresa just had, you know, her covers pulled off and Karen, got her, you know, the thing with the shower curtain. So they're sitting there freaking out. And then they saw some black, I'm not really sure how she described it. It was like a black shape. Teresa said it was like a man floating up near the ceiling, like a shadow figure, like, on the ceiling, I guess.
Yeah.
They didn't describe it real well. And then, see, this might be referring to a part that they took out because they were talking about the man floating up by the ceiling, and then they have Teresa on there, the real girl, and she said, "It felt like 1,000 hands all over you." And I'm like, that doesn't sound like a man floating up by the ceiling. That sounds like some ghost molestation. So maybe they did have that scene, and then they had her talking about that, but then they took that out. Yeah. Because I was like, that's a weird thing for her to say, because that's not, like, related to what they were talking about. But that's maybe,
Yeah, which is kind of frustrating, because now you have the television programs interfering with the damn witness testimony. So A Haunting, unfortunately, does that a lot.
Yeah.
They interfere with the witness testimony for, I don't know, censorship reasons. I'd rather know exactly what the witnesses said. And the timeline of how the story had changed. But we'll see.
Yeah, because, I mean, a lot of times these cases, because when we've done episodes before, a lot of times, unless the case is really famous, like this one, you can't really find a lot of other, like, outside information about the shit, you know?
And then if you were going through the old talk shows, you'd have to find the old talk shows. You had to put them in order. And then you'd have to just hope that there's enough in the story to make a timeline. Because I remember Miss Snedeker, when the fucking audience would start fucking with her, she'd just come up with some crazy shit that you had never heard before about the case.
Yeah.
To try to back up what she was saying. So you don't know when that was added to the story, because you only have recordings. You know what I mean? You don't know her. You weren't hanging out with her, you know, how the story had evolved or not. So you don't know. But it's just, that's the problem with a lot of these cases, that you don't witness yourself. You're dependent on witness testimony. And sometimes people are in the way of the witness testimony. So it's a problem.
Danny Rowling said, insert, where is that raccoon sound effect?
Okay,
maybe we should.
Where is that raccoon? There you go.
I keep forgetting I have that too. I went to all the trouble to make that. And it's like, I just keep fucking forgetting. But they said they saw something with some kind of blackness or some kind of like shadow shape or something like that, like up by the ceiling. Then Teresa's rosary lifts itself up and like breaks. So like all the beads go flying everywhere. Then the phone rings again, but this time it's Ed telling her, holy shit, the truck just started and drove right through my office. It looked like a construction site, so it was like one of those little offices that's kind of like, you know, just a little prefab type of thing. So it drove through there. He wasn't hurt or anything, but it just seemed kind of weird. So at this point, they now suspect the entity is real, no duh, and can follow them wherever they go, because they figure, hey, if it followed Ed to work, then it can go anywhere if they move or whatever. So at this point, they're like, okay, well, we got to call the priest. Now, before the priest gets there, Bobby said he was sleeping in the living room, and he thought he heard Paul calling his name. That's his brother, and his brother has been committed. He's at the hospital, so he's obviously not in the house anymore. So he said he heard his brother, though, and it sounded just like him, and it sounded like it was luring him down to the basement, and he was kind of, like, laughing and stuff, and he's, like, pretty weirded out, knowing Paul isn't there, and yet, like, following the voice anyway, which I would absolutely not be doing that. But Bobby then gets distracted by a kind of a knock on the front door, but turns out it's just the priest. That was like a little bit of a fake. It wasn't a jump scare, but it was just a little fake out there. So they said they bring the priest in, and he listens to them and seems to believe what they're saying is true. But then he tells them, well, the best thing to do is just ignore the shit, because paying attention to the evil gives it more power. Karen thought, I don't think he knew what the fuck he was talking about, because it's like, if you were here and like we experienced all this stuff, like you can't ignore the shit. Like, how the fuck are we supposed to do that? You know what I mean? Because of all the crazy shit that was going on. So she's like, she didn't say she thought he was full of shit, but that's what she wanted to say. Like, that's what I said, but that's what it sounded like. So at this point, Karen remembered that a few weeks ago, she'd read an article about, guess who? The Warrens. So she hadn't really thought much about it at the time, but now she's like, well, I'm desperate, so I'm going to call them up and see what they have to say about it. So they tell the Warrens about the haunting, and apparently at this point, they tell them, like, everybody in the family has seen something or experienced something other than the one son, Mark, who I guess is, like, the second youngest or whatever. I don't know why he never saw anything, but whatever. So Lorraine comes to the house and is immediately drawn to the basement. And she called the place. She said it was horrible. She said it was a very, very bad infestation. So, you know what I mean? Of course, she says it's a demon. And called it overwhelmingly sickening. She said also that there was a door to hell in the basement, conveniently. I mean, like, not literally, but there was, like, a portal to hell in the basement. How many houses has she gone to and said, well, you got a portal to hell? How many portals?
Bottom.
There's a lot. There's a lot of portals.
Yeah, they got a whole, like, a subway system. Got the red line, the blue line, the green line. You never know when them bitches are going to open up. Oh, where's it going? Going to Gehenna, Guyana, or hell? Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Is this the expression?
Yeah. It's all these different regions of hell you can go to.
Yeah. Oh, that's the bad neighborhood you don't want to go.
Yeah.
All right, so the Warrens say, they're like, okay, well, you got a problem here, obviously. And it's like, well, we got to go approach the Catholic Church to get an exorcism, the kind of more rare kind that's actually done on places rather than people, I guess. I think they had a name for it, but I can't remember what it was. So the Warrens call good old John Zaffis, who Danny Rowling brought up before. John Zaffis is their researcher. He's also their nephew, in case you didn't know that. So he's basically supposed to go to the house and document the haunting so he can take all the evidence to the church to get permission to do the exorcism. So the research, him and his research team move into the house for a little while, I don't know how long it was, and set up all their equipment. The Warrens also tell them it's probably a good idea because the demon will try to like isolate you from one another, so everybody sleep in the living room and stay together at all times, like never go anywhere you by yourself because that's going to be a bad time. Now, the demon apparently set its sights on the next most vulnerable person now that Paul is out of the house. That person turns out to be Karen, the mom. So she said that they were all in the living room, and she said that she fell backward, and then, like, her neck started swelling up and her face contorted. And she said that she felt like she went to... The way she described it, like I said, she's not great at describing things, but the way she described it, it almost seemed like she went... mentally, like, to another place, and she said, like, surrounded by all these kind of, like, shadowy figures and got attacked by, like, dark emotions, all, like, sadness and anger and hopelessness and yada yada. But, so everybody's there when it happens, so they see what happens, so they go at her with the holy water into prayer and blah blah blah, and apparently the entity let her go, and she said that when she returned normal, she came back, you know, to consciousness or whatever, they told her that she'd been out for 8 hours, although... I'm guessing the implication is she felt like it had only, like, been a couple of minutes, but they said it was 8 hours. She said that while she was out, that she realized that there was true evil in the world and that you actually have to choose the good, otherwise the evil's going to get you. One thing that John Zaffis said on the show, because he was on the show as well, was that all the team's mattresses that they slept on, because they had, like, air mattresses and shit, like, and they slept on in the living room, that the mattresses would, like, breathe. He said they, like, breathed and undulated, like, and it kept the everybody in the team awake. Like, the demon was just, like, fucking with people.
I remember that.
Because he's a jerk.
Yeah.
She's like, gonna keep you awake. What an asshole. Zaffis also said this was the strongest demonic possession he'd ever experienced. And as I mentioned, the demon liked to isolate people, which is why the team encouraged everybody to stay together. But one night, John Zaffis, not following his own advice apparently, went off by himself to make some notes or check equipment or something. And he said while he was in the room, it got really, really cold, and he started calling for somebody to come see him, but nobody responded. And then he went into the living room and everyone was still asleep, even though he was like yelling for them. And he said that he felt as though whatever was going to happen was like meant only for him. Like the demon was just like trying to keep all the other people asleep. So he opened the basement door, it looked like, and he saw the man in the suit, like the demon guy. And then he sees like a burst of After Effects fire, like coming up from there. So it was like an explosion that kind of like blew him backward. And as Danny Rowling mentioned before, after that, he was like so terrified that he noped out. He's like, nope, I'm out. He said that was the scariest thing. It's like, what kind of demon fighter are you, bud? You just get one little burst of fire and like one little sighting of a demon and you're just like, I thought you were supposed to like be fighting the demon.
Yeah, there's more to that. I've seen some interviews with this guy, dug it up a long time ago. He said that it threatened him and his family if he didn't leave. That was
They
showed him some images of what it could do, and he doesn't want to talk about it, so then he split. Another guy from his team said that they were setting up a camera down a hallway, and as he was setting it up, he saw a phenomenon. It sounded kind of legitimate. He saw what looked like a bunch of little pieces of paper and debris start to spin and pick up off the ground and spin into like a little miniature, kind of like a dust devil, you know, or a little miniature, what do you call that?
Tornado.
Like a little miniature tornado kind of came up And it was happening in front of an open window where light was coming in. You know, sometimes in a dusty environment, you see like the dust inside the fucking shaft of light.
Mm-hmm.
And he could see that it was kind of dust and things and little pieces from the carpeting or something. Fucking, he could see it would blowing up into a little tornado type thing. And it started to kind of coalesce into a humanoid shape. And then it, I think he said he ran from it in fear, but then went right back once he got it, regained his composure. It was gone. I think that's how it ended. But that was weird.
Yeah, they didn't mention that on this.
Yeah,
on this weird. Show. And I don't remember if they mentioned that on the Paranormal Witness show. Probably if we'd had more time, we should have watched the Paranormal Witness episode too. Although we've seen that one a bunch of times.
Yeah,
I remember.
Well,
that
was that investigator's, the guy that ran. It was his partner that saw that. He was setting
up. Who's Zaphis?
Yeah, I guess it was Zaphis's partner. A guy who was setting up a camera. A guy who was investigating.
Yeah, because he brought a whole team there.
Right.
It looked like. And, I couldn't tell.
I saw his testimony. It was creepy, kind of plausible sounding. You know, he's not saying a whole lot. He's just saying he saw a little tornado form of little particles in that shaft of light, and it started to coalesce into what he thought was a person. And he ran from it. But then, like, I regained his composure just like a second or two after that, and then went around that corner and looked at it, and it had dissipated. Weird.
That is pretty weird. So Zaphis runs off. Apparently, I guess, like, the rest of the team stayed there. They didn't really make that clear. So, at this point, the Connecticut diocese sends out another guy named Father Frank to see. He wants to do an investigation, too, to see if they'll grant an exorcism. So maybe everybody did leave. I'm not really sure. So the family tells Father Frank everything, and he took a tour around the house, but they couldn't really tell, like, if he believed them or not, because he was just, like, stayed very stoic and shit. He just came in, like, did his little investigation thing and wrote a report and then submitted it. But they noted the church did actually grant the exorcism, though. So I guess he did believe them, I suppose. So then they bring in this other priest, Father Richard, and he's the guy that's going to do the exorcism. Now, he did a cleansing on the house, which, of course, provoked the entity, because that's how it works on this show. In the basement, like, Karen, I guess, is following him while he was going around doing all the cleansing or whatever, and she said that while she was following him, she saw, she didn't describe it like this, but the way she, I was like, I think I know what she's talking about. It seemed like something invisible, like, pulled the back of his shirt like that. You know what I mean? Like, she saw, like, the material of the shirt,
yeah, I remember
like,
that.
Come out like that. And she's like, and he's kind of, she said he made a face and kind of looked, but he didn't say anything. Because he's one of the people, like, the original priest that came in there is like, you have to pretend that it's not happening. Like, you're supposed to ignore it because it gives it more power if you get scared or whatever. So you have to, like, just act all, like, fucking chill and everything. That's the thing. And actually, they had some other, like, guy on there. I can't remember what his name was. He's kind of well-known because I've seen him on some other paranormal shows. But he wrote a book called American Exorcist or something. So he was on there, and he's, like, saying that technically, like, ideally, that when an exorcist goes in your house, like, to do an exorcism of your house, they're actually supposed to go in there assuming that the demon isn't real, which I thought was an interesting thing to say. But he's like, you're supposed to be coming at it from a position of skepticism rather than belief, which I thought that was kind of interesting. I'd never heard that before. But I forgot to write that down, but it was, like, so interesting that I just remembered it just now when I was, like, thinking about it. So the priest is, like, trying to ignore, like, whatever is happening, because he knows the demon's trying to, like, provoke him or get him scared, and that, like, gives him power or whatever. So, there's apparently, I don't know if this is what really happened, but they heard, like, a bunch of growly jazz or whatever. And then, again, the priest is trying to ignore it. So then they go up into the main part of the house, and they set up, like, the whole little deal with a little altar and whatnot. And so they're doing that, and then apparently, I don't know if this really happened or not, but this is what they showed on the show. It's like a bunch of books and shit, like, start falling off the shelves. All kind of crazy shit starts falling off the shelves. Karen gets picked up and thrown back against the wall in what was actually, like, a pretty decent special effect, I thought. Well, at least what I could see, like, on the low-res video, where she was just like, and it's like, the funny thing is that happened, and then the niece, Teresa, she said she got picked up by the neck, like, off the ground and was, like, choking and stuff, but everybody had to pretend, like, that nothing was happening so the demon wouldn't get a foothold, I guess. Mm-hmm. So they just kind of had to sit there and pretend nothing was going on, which I don't know why I thought that was so funny, but I did. So Then it kind of looked like they had like a Virgin Mary statue there. It kind of looked like it was melting, although it was kind of hard to tell because the copy that we watched this on was like fucking, it was on YouTube and it looked like butt because it was just kind of like super, super low res. So I'm like, I'm looking at it like that. Like, I'm like, is it melting? I can't really tell. I guess it was melting. So apparently the exorcism worked because they said the whole vibe of the house changed while the priest was praying. Now, even though the family believed the entity was gone, they still decided to move out of the house not long after the exorcism. They made it seem on the show that it's like they, as soon as the exorcism was over, they were like, fuck it, I'm out. That's not the case. They actually lived there for another 2 years before they moved out. But on the show, they made it seem like, no, we just got the fuck out of there because the house had too many bad memories and it's like we didn't want a chance like opening the door to hell again or whatever. Now, at the end of the show, and like I said, this kind of made me sad, but they just like at the end of the show, they said Paul was released from the hospital a bit later. Like I said, in real life, it was about a month and a half. And though the program said his cancer didn't return, that's not what ultimately happened. Like I said, it didn't return for a while. But it did actually come back later on. Like I said, he did marry and he had 3 or 4 kids. But the cancer did come back and he actually died in 2012. I'm not sure how old he was. He wasn't that old. I think he was only in his 40s. So let's kind of talk about, that was the end of the show. So let me talk a little bit about this because I kind of feel like they gave a lot of inconsistent accounts, like I said, Carmen specifically, and I kind of feel like the publicity around the case, that she actually used it because later on, she went on as a career as like a spiritual advisor. She had a website and everything. She actually married again later on, so I think she goes by Carmen Reed now, or did like last I heard. And remember how I said that there was a book written about this case back in 1992? And it was called In a Dark Place, and the guy that wrote it was a horror writer, and his name was Ray Garten. And he has been very public about saying that I was hired by Ed and Lorraine Warren to write a book about the case, but he never went in the house. He never talked to the kid that was supposedly, the kid with cancer. He never talked to him. And he claims that Ed Warren told him flat out that the Snedekers were crazy and that Ray Garten should just make up details about the haunting to make the book scarier, because all of the stories they were getting from all the family members were varied wildly. And so Ed was just like, don't worry about it. Just write whatever. Make it scary. You're a horror writer, basically. Mm. That's what the author said that wrote the book about it. And he's not shy about talking about it either.
He says that they were just all over the place, huh?
Yeah. And because, he asked Ed about it because he was like, well, what the fuck am I supposed to do with all this? Because all their stories are different. And Ed was just like, whatever, you're a horror writer, like, make something up. Just make it scary.
Now, did they contradict?
I'm not sure if they contradicted, but it just seemed like I said, just they would say different things at different times. Sometimes they would add on details that they hadn't brought up before. It's just like all kind of shit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I'd like to have a really good interview with that guy.
Yeah, I wonder if he's still around. Cause like
maybe
I said,
we can get him
like,
on a show.
Maybe that might be a really interesting show.
Yeah.
Because like I said, he was more known for horror fiction, really. But it's like, they hired him for that.
Yeah, but you're a writer, too. You could get him on a show, probably.
Yeah, I probably could.
Yeah, our connections, we can get him on a show.
And
nice.
As I mentioned, too, like Carmen...
If he's around.
Carmen claimed on several occasions that she didn't know that the house had been a mortuary until after moving in, and said that she hadn't been able to go to the basement before signing the lease because there was construction shit blocking the entrance to the basement. But the house's owner said that is not the case. They said, we told the Snedekers outright the house used to be a funeral home well before they moved in. And people in the neighborhood knew that it had been a mortuary, obviously, because, it was a mortuary. They lived there. They saw it every day. And honestly, Carmen, even in her own statements, like later, she wrote an account of the case later, like on her website. And she just made this offhand comment that her and her family knew the home was a former mortuary, but we weren't bothered by it prior to moving in. So it's like she said before, oh, we didn't know until we moved in. But then later on, she said, oh, we knew about it and it didn't bother us. You know what I mean? So she said like two different things. Now, according to several of the family statements, the disturbances started shortly after they'd settled into the house, and it seemed like the early shit was like a poltergeist infestation. You know, most of the early stuff they reported, like I said, was the crosses, crucifixes, like, disappearing off the walls, unexplained voices coming from empty rooms, and the thing about the, you know, the dishes, like, disappearing, like, she would set the table and then turn around and the dishes were back in the cabinet. Like, she said that happened a bunch. And she said about the mop water, like, and the blood and everything, and the shower curtain. And, also, the son, the one with cancer, said that, no, not the one with cancer, the younger one. He actually said the lights would flicker off and on, like I said, when even though the bulbs had been removed. And they said this house smelled really bad all the time, like a dead body, like decay. They didn't mention that on the show. And basically, you know, they didn't mention, too, that Philip, which was the actual name of the kid with cancer, that he wrote about necrophiliac fantasies in his notebook and like pictures and stuff. And I mentioned this earlier, but the basement room, at least as far as I could determine, was actually the casket display room, not the embalming room, like they showed on the show. But the thing about it is that Carmen, she kind of said at first, she's like, well, I didn't really notice any particular paranormal activity at first. It was only happening to the kids and I didn't believe them, which is kind of what they showed on this show. But then, like, in later ones, she said that she saw stuff, like, weird shit, like, early on. So, again, like, kind of inconsistent. And then she also said that on some occasions she saw apparitions herself, which they absolutely did not mention on this show. She said that she saw one with long black hair and black eyes, and then she saw another one with white hair and white eyes who was wearing a tuxedo. So they did not mention that on this show, that she said that she saw apparitions. They made it seem like the kids just saw them and she didn't believe it, but they didn't show her seeing any apparitions on this show, but she said that later that she did. And basically, too, it just seemed like, I don't know, so he did, like, Philip did actually, like, attack the cousin, Tammy. So that did happen, and he got taken away for psychiatric evaluation. He got diagnosed as schizophrenic, and as I mentioned, was hospitalized for about a month and a half. And he did tell the doctors, apparently, that he thought the house was evil and was making him do terrible things. That doesn't necessarily mean the house was haunted. I mean, it might mean that he had schizophrenia, and so that's just something he was saying. And she did say, like, Carmen did mention the whole thing about the invisible hand crawling up Tammy's shirt and sexually assaulting her. Like I said, they didn't show that on the show, but that was a claim that she made all the time. And the Warrens basically came in and they said that a lot of the family reported being, like, they would get slapped all the time, like, by invisible hands would slap them. And they were the ones, because I think Danny Rowling brought this up before, that the reason that this was happening is that people that worked in the mortuary had engaged in necrophilia. There is absolutely no evidence that that happened. Not saying it didn't happen, but there's no evidence that it happened. That pretty much came from the Warrens as far as I could determine. So I don't know if they were trying to make it more salacious to sell more books. That's kind of where I'm at with it. But yeah, those allegations have not been confirmed. There's no confirmation that anything like that was going on in there. Basically, they said, yeah, we did the cleansing on the house and, you know, there wasn't any more activity. So as I mentioned, even though on the show, it made it seem like the Snedekers were like, as soon as the exorcism was done, it was successful, they were like, yeah, but we still moved out. They actually lived there for another 2 years, and then they moved to Tennessee. As I said, Carmen is now using the last name Reed, and she's a spiritual advisor. Philip died in 2012. Now, the house is, I believe that the house is still owned by a woman named Susan Trotta Smith. Now, as far as I know, like I said, I checked Zillow, and the last time the house was sold was 1998. And I'm assuming that's when she bought it, and apparently she still lives there because no one has bought it since then. And she has been pretty vocal in the media saying, look, I've lived in this house now at this point, if it's been since 1998, it's a long funkin' time. She said, I've lived there all this time, and I've had no problem at all. Really, the only problem I have is, like, now that the movie came out, you know, back in 2009, is, like, people, like, parking on my lawn and taking pictures of my house and shit like that because it's so high profile. And like I said, it's very, very easy to find the address of this house online. I found it in less than 2 minutes, and I'm sure you probably could too. Also, people that had lived in the house prior to the Snedekers also said that no paranormal activity took place in the house while they were staying there either. And as I said, the woman that lives there now has lived there for several decades at this point and has never had anything bad happen. So she doesn't really believe the shit either. So that's how that's going. How do you feel about
that? Well, my thing on that is that people are taking this as a haunted house. And based on the stories, I don't even think it's a haunted house. It sounds like poltergeist to me. So just because she hasn't seen anything in the house doesn't mean that it didn't happen. If it happened, it happened because of that boy.
Yeah.
You know, it was a manifestation coming out of him. So just because the new owners don't see anything doesn't mean that it didn't happen. The problem is that the case is very muddied.
Yeah.
You have to go back to the earliest testimonies. And really, the key would be that horror writer. He probably has access to that. He probably saw problems in the story. If there were contradictions, that could be a sign that this is a hoax. But we just don't know enough.
I mean, everything, like, he never went to the house, but he did like interview the family members. And from everything that I could determine, he actually went to Ed Warren because the Warrens hired him, right?
Yeah.
Went to Ed Warren and said, I don't know how to make this into, like, a story, essentially, because everything they're telling me is, like, wildly deviating from one another.
Okay.
And so he didn't really know how he was going to do it. And he said, allegedly, at that point, that Ed Warren said to him, well, just make something up.
Yeah, well, that's not...
just make it scary.
That doesn't mean much about the case, either, because Ed would say that on a good case.
Well, yeah,
case.
That's true.
That's just the way he was. So maybe something did happen there. Maybe the witnesses were confused or told it in a way to where it was confusing because maybe they were freaked out. Maybe their imaginations ran wild with them, so the descriptions were fucking not accurate. Or maybe the timeline was... I mean, even I got confused about some of the stuff that happened in Mammoth, especially over time, okay? Because a lot of stuff happened, so I don't remember the exact order that certain things happened in. So maybe that's what he's talking about. I'd have to talk to that guy who wrote that book.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah. I mean, like, that's the thing, though. When you told me about Mammoth Mountain.
Yeah.
And then I talked to your aunt and uncle.
Yeah.
And they told me about what they experienced at Mammoth Mountain.
Yeah.
There were tiny, tiny differences, but not really. And I didn't really have a problem, like... bringing them together because you guys mostly said the same shit. It's like little tiny things would be different. Like, oh, I thought that happened like on Saturday and you thought it happened on Sunday. But it was just like little shit like that. Like the large details were all the same.
I was 14 or 15 at the time. You know what I mean?
So yeah.
It was a long time.
No, you were younger than that.
Younger than that?
You were 12 or 13.
13? Okay.
Something like that.
I've seen pictures of myself. I'm surprisingly full grown looking for fucking 13. I didn't look that different at 16. But one of the things that I was really astounded that I had gotten wrong is that I thought the lamp that moved, that we saw, you know, or that ended up being moved mysteriously, I remembered it being a blue lamp that looked like a bunch of logs lashed together on a dock that had a damn life preserver hanging off of it.
Yeah, I've seen lamps like that.
Yeah, that was what I thought the lamp that moved looked like. Lois and Red said, no, it wasn't that lamp. Said that lamp was in there, but it wasn't that one. It was the one that looked like the a bunch of damn wax. Spun-looking wax. It looked like a bunch of wax ribbon. Remember that?
Like those candles.
Those candles, yeah.
I used to have a candle
it was like
that,
extruded,
that looked like those ribbon.
Extruded when it was fucking melted plastic and everything. And it was like, that's the one that moved.
But see, that's not weird.
And then I remembered it going, yeah, I remember that lamp. I remember that lamp now, but so I got confused about which lamp it was that moved.
But see, that's not that weird because it's like that other lamp was actually in the place.
Yeah,
it's just you just forgot which one it was that moved.
And Lois, I know, got some shit wrong. She said she saw the damn twist tie from the bread write the word "go" on the glass, and no, I remember going upstairs and finding that on the ground, and it was already written. But her memory was that she saw it being written. I found it. And it was already written when I found it.
Well, crap, man, I can't even remember shit that happened a month ago.
Yeah.
Much less when I was 13. I don't remember jack shit from when I was 13 years old.
And there was some shit that I had forgotten all about. I'd forgotten all about the Hot Wheel cars for a long time. I'd forgotten all about the knife that got thrown out of the from the kitchen. Forgot all about that. And that was a major fucking incident. I know I blocked that out because that scared the shit out of me when that fucking knife went and fucking almost hit the damn fucking sliding glass door, bounced off of nothing in midair, and fell at my fucking feet. Boom! Like that. And it didn't even bounce. That scared the shit out of me. I almost went unconscious. And Red saw it happen. And I instantly forgot about it. Like, I couldn't accept it.
Yeah.
An hour later, I had forgotten all about it. I remember. I remember that I had forgotten about it.
I remember that I forgot about it.
I forced myself not to think about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like shit. I said, not surprising. You were just a kid, and it was, like, really traumatic, so.
Yeah, that fucking knife flying out of that damn kitchen. An empty kitchen.
Yeah. Pretty creepy.
Yeah. Going straight as a bullet, like an arrow. Fast. Weird.
It is weird. All right. Are we ready to wrap it up?
Yeah, we can shut it down. I'm going to start on that chicken.
Yeah, he's got to
go. Yeah. Yeah, man.
Somebody earlier said we should make a 13 o'clock shirt that says, "Are you hungry yet?" on it.
Yeah. Fucking right.
Well, it's been almost 2 hours, but this was a good episode. This is a good episode to talk about because there's, like I said, there's a lot of other information about this case too because there's been so many iterations of it. But so I'm glad you guys recommended it. It was a bitch to like to find, and we had to watch like a crappy version of it on YouTube. But we got it done. We watched it. So thanks everybody for dropping by this evening. And tomorrow, I guess we got to watch a movie tonight to talk about tomorrow. But I don't know which one. Maybe we should watch Time Bandits. Can we watch Time Bandits?
Yeah.
I've been wanting to do Time Bandits for a long time. I think it's still on HBO Max. I'll check. But because I was excited when I saw it in there because I haven't seen that in a long time either. So maybe we'll do that. If not, then we'll find something else to do. But yeah, so thanks everybody for dropping by today. And we'll see you guys again tomorrow evening. Good night.